As we were hearing earlier on the programme, the whole issue of universal benefits has been brought sharply into focus by the Labour Party in Scotland. Early this week, Joanne Lamont said benefits such as free prescriptions and free tuition fees should be up for debate when she said it was time to end the something-for-nothing culture. In this, the Scottish leader has won the support of our UK leader, Ed Miliband.
She was saying she's not going to shy away from making those difficult choices, and she's not going to pretend that you can just do everything, that money grows on trees. I think it was a really well-judged and important speech, and it speaks to the theme of our conference, which is how do we build an economy that works for everyone and not just a few at the top.
So what are the pros and cons of universal benefits? Paul Spicker is a professor of public policy at Robert Gordon University.
Oh, I think that there are at least three things that people have in their minds. The first is the idea that there should be rights to certain kinds of welfare provision. The most obvious example of that is healthcare, where people feel very strongly that it is morally wrong to leave people in need of healthcare when they can't otherwise afford it. The second thing is that there's a sense of what's sometimes called social inclusion, it's sometimes called solidarity, the sense that we all have a responsibility towards each other, that we're all in a society together, that we all share responsibilities. The third basic principle is, I suppose, simply a sense of self-interest, that the way to protect yourself is to insure yourself. We know what happens in countries where the state and government don't provide this. The answer is that people club together, you have mutual insurance, and that people will join this sort of arrangement voluntarily because it's the obvious thing to do.
Is there also a sense that even those on better incomes have a sense of getting something for their taxes? It's not just those who can't necessarily afford the services.
What happens if you cut out or exclude people who are better off? There are two big things that happen here. The first is that rich people resent having to pay for services that they can get no conceivable benefit from. The other thing that happens is that you get two-tier services, that rich people will have their own services, poorer people or people who are less well off will have their services, and the services for people who are poor are always poorer services.
So do you think there is some argument, as the polls would suggest, that there's a middle ground here, that people think, well, if you are extremely wealthy, perhaps you shouldn't have the state paying for certain things for you?
I'm not sure that there is a middle ground in practical terms. If you decide that you're not going to have provision for better off people, then either you've got to make some kind of provision separately, which is what they do in Germany, or alternatively, you've got to have some way of picking out who falls into that richer category and who doesn't. That means that there's got to be some mechanism, some extra means test or test of income or test of need, which applies to people. And that invariably means it's going to be more complicated.
When it comes to means testing, what are the potential pitfalls there?
Oh, well, there are many pitfalls. There are some things which happen to all benefits, not just to means-tested benefits. Benefits can get very complicated. People don't necessarily know they're entitled. They don't know that the benefits are intended for people like them. Now, that's true of means-tests, but it's true of other benefits as well. But then we've got certain things which are especially true of means-tests. People's income doesn't stay stable week by week and month by month. We know from work that's been done, for example, for the revenue and customs, that there are an awful lot of people whose incomes double or halve in a three-month period. So there's a constant movement, and people don't know that their situation is relevant, they don't know what they're entitled to, they don't know when they're entitled. So certainly what we get, I suppose, a combination of two problems. We get some people who are entitled to benefits and who don't receive them because, for whatever reasons, they're not claiming. And then we get other people who are claiming after they've ceased to be entitled, when they don't know often that they've ceased to be entitled. And then we get massive problems. We've had this with tax credits, where people have been required to repay benefits, sometimes thousands of pounds of benefits, because they've been getting money that they're not entitled to. And that's serious trouble for the people involved. The Ombudsman laid into the tax credit system when it was established, saying that it just wasn't a fit and proper system for people who are on unstable incomes and in unpredictable circumstances.
How then, as a society, can we decide which benefits should be universal?
This is an extremely difficult question. Clearly, offering things universal means that it's got to be paid for in another way. And usually that means that it has to be paid for either by taxes or by some kind of general contribution. But because we've got a tax system, it means that everybody already has at least one means test. When we get ourselves into a dreadful mess is when we try to introduce new tests and new rules. We've seen this, for example, in the pig's breakfast that's been made about trying to charge for child benefit to better off couples. There isn't a clear mechanism by which to do it, so things start to get very complicated.
But there have to be some lines, obviously.
Clearly, yes.
So how do we make those decisions, do you think?
That could be enormously difficult. You may know that we don't give older people the opportunity of having a mobility allowance or the mobility component that younger people get. Now, that's a difficult decision. I'm not sure it's the right one. I would like to see mobility provision extended for much older people, but we need to be aware that if we were to do that, it would be expensive, and then almost certainly it would happen at the expense of something else.
So, Paul, do you think this is a good time now just to say, let's look at what we're doing, what we're spending, see if we could do it better, and maybe have other things on the table for discussion?
There is never a wrong time in that sense. But clearly, at a time of major cuts, what tends to happen is that certain provisions become a hostage to fortune, that we find that governments say, this is a bad idea, we want to cut that out. And the fundamental problem with that is that you're often leaving people who are very vulnerable, with substantial needs, worse off as a result. So it's not the best time to make serious major economies in benefits.
Professor Paul Spicker there of Robert Gordon University.